La 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 la.
Yeah, well, so, but the beard, though, I want to make sure that we're clear here. I know Dave inspires a lot of people, and he is, of course, if he's not known for being a trendsetter, I don't know what he is. The beard wasn't inspired by Dave, though.
Not really. It was more laziness. and it was before the pandemic started, so I can't even use that as an excuse. It just was, I had grown them before to a certain length and gotten rid of them. But I don't know. I feel like it suits my head. It makes my head look smaller. So
Seth Rogen talked about how the idea of the facial hair can change the shape of your face, and he really likes that. And that's why you see Seth Rogen, and whenever you see him, he's got a different length of beard many times because he just likes playing with changing of his face. You said your wife she puts up with it. She's accepted it.
She's grown to accept it. Though actually last night she asked when it was coming off and she tugged at it like this just to see the shape of my head and go, she said, "I miss your face. It'll grow back." So we'll see. I have I don't want to give it away, but I have a little musical project that I'm going to be recording soon, maybe this week. And then maybe after that, I'll give it a rest. We'll see.
Is it like a Soggy Bottom Boys type thing where the beard will actually help, or what are we talking about?
I don't want to give too much
no,
away.
No, don't give it away. Don't give it away.
Yes, absolutely. You almost
when it comes
it
out, let us know. And with all the power and might of the Letterman podcast, if there's anything to promote with our family and friends, we will certainly do that. Before we get going on the Letterman talk, Dave Rogalski, coincidentally, and I'm not telling any tales out of school, nor am I admitting that there might be any Gilmore Girls fandom in my life whatsoever. Interesting how Dave Rogalski, not the most common name in the world, yet there was a certain Mr. Brody in Gilmore Girls who had that same name. The character had that same name. Pretty coincidental, isn't it?
No. my wife worked on the show, and the character Lane was sort of based on her. And the second season, Dan and Amy Palladino wanted to come up with a boyfriend for Lane, and they said, "We need to get Lane her Dave Rogalski." So they just stuck with the name. And the other connection I have is the band on the show is called Hep Alien, which is an anagram for Helen Pye. And the bass player in the band on the show didn't play bass. So I played bass for him off camera, which was a blast to be able to.
And Helen Pye, by the way, your wife.
Yes.
Yes. If so
I didn't make that clear.
Oh my God. I love clever Easter eggs and things like that. Now, okay. So where were you working at the time when these episodes were airing? What were you doing at the time then at that point?
That was Gilmore started in the year 2000. And I believe in 2000, I was on a show called Lucky.
Okay.
It was a scripted show on FX.
Yeah.
And then Orlando Jones talk show, which was also on FX, bouncing around. I was just bouncing around a bunch of different Comedy Central shows at that time.
Gotcha. Did people around you during the airing of these episodes make the connection? Did they know, like, whether they're an inside joke? Every once in a while, would you get that, or was it only after the fact that people started putting two and two together?
It was after the fact. The people that knew that were close to us knew, and my best friend Brian Zydiak was the guitar player for Sebastian Bach's character. Sebastian Bach joined after Adam Brody left to go to the OC, and he didn't really play guitar. So my close friends knew. It was, and my mom, she always enjoyed it. So,
mom must have loved that.
Yes. Absolutely.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
So, okay. So 2000, that is long past your Letterman days. What were the years that you were working for the big show for Dave and Company?
I started as an intern in 84.
Yep.
And I remember I went to school at Ohio University. And I was walking in between classes down the hallway, and I heard people talking about the internship being available. And it just was like, whoa, what? There's such a thing? And, you know, this was before the internet. So
yep.
I don't remember how I sleuthed the phone number. I guess I just looked, called information and asked for NBC in New York and got through to the show, got through to Paula Niedert, had went to New York for the first time for an interview. And it was between me and another kid. And the only opening they had was for a graphics internship. And yeah. The other kid only wanted to do the writing internship. And I said, I'll do whatever. And so I got the offer and went to New York for that spring of 84, working with Ed Hall and Rick Sheckman.
And, okay, so a couple of names who in the background, I've actually been communicating with Ed. We're going to get him on the show here very, very soon. And Shecky has been one of my number one confidants in the building of this show here. So very, very cool. Mark Carson as well. Would you have been working with Mark as well?
Yeah. All the graphics department, Bob Pook.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And there was another woman in the graphics department. I can't remember her last name, but no, that was a lot of fun. One of the first things I did, they sent me out to take pictures of steaming manhole covers with a Polaroid, and it was for a bookmobile book. That was, I think the joke was cheap places to sleep in New York for tourists. And so that was like my first creative input on the show was just taking Polaroids. It was a weird start to an internship.
I was just going to say, yeah, you're 19, 20 at the time?
21.
You were legal. You were just legal.
Yeah.
Sicked on the streets of New York to take pictures of steaming manhole covers. We're not in Kansas anymore.
The first day I took a cab, I was staying at a YMCA, yeah. And I literally could have walked there, but I didn't know New York at all. So I took a cab. And I got out of the cab on the street side, and I almost took out a bike messenger who threatened to kill me. The cab driver asked where I was going. I said, Letterman show, I'm going to intern. He goes, oh, what channel's that on? And I said, I don't know. It was New York. I don't know what channel anything is in New York. And he thought that was hilarious. So that was an auspicious beginning.
It's fantastic. It's almost, it's also almost, you know, cinematic in the sense you think about the, you know, and we're not in Kansas anymore, literally, like, you know, we're not in Ohio anymore, suddenly in dropped into the middle of New York. And I mean, how many times have we seen a stereotype of somebody, you know, stranger in a strange land, and New York being the background of that? You lived it. Now, okay, so Late Night had, of course, the reputation as it was picking up steam, and you certainly showed up there as that steam was really starting to pick up, not just the steam of a manhole cover, but momentum for the show. Now, the lore or the legend is that with Late Night, it was the college kids who were up watching it. Now, you hear this rumor, you start sleuthing around, you dial 411. And by the way, kids, that's where the 411 comes from. It's picking up the old phone, dialing 411, and what city you're looking for. Okay. Who are you looking for? Like that's where 411 came from, kids. So there's one to grow on right there for you. Were you one of those kids? Was your college dorm one of those dorms that was watching Late Night already? Like, were you excited about this because you were excited about that show already? And the college kids had kind of been the early adopters of it. Were you one of those?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And at first I remember maybe even being off put by it. Because my girlfriend at the time covered her dorm room with People magazine covers. So it was just celebrity faces just staring at me. And there was she idolized it. And then Letterman comes on and he's tearing all that down. And I was like, wait a second. So he sort of tore the veneer of celebrity away. And it's like, oh, I get it. This is all PR. I'm being forced to like this.
Oh.
And these people aren't untouchable, and they should be made fun of. So, you know, and then just the oddness and of the show grew on me personally as just the comedy of it. And it was, you know, the opposite of Carson. And we all stayed up watching Carson as well. I was, you know, not ever intending that I was going to be a comedy writer, but just studying the monologue with Carson was like, how did he come up with that? How did they come up with that? How do they make a joke? And then studying it from Dave's viewpoint was just a whole other world and way to look at stuff. So it definitely was a cultural thing and timing.
I love that. I love that there was a literal, like, because we, you know, that's what the lore is. The lore is that, you know, he makes fun of celebrity and all of that stuff. You're talking, you're literally going back and confirming at the time, you know, the example of the People magazine, you know, covers being on the wall. And by the way, I'm not sure what's worse, making out with a girlfriend in a dorm room with dolls looking at you or all those celebrities. I don't know what would be worse.
A lot of pressure. A lot of pressure.
Jeez. Oh, God, I just looked at Michael J. Fox. Oh, no. Like, I love this because that is what Dave was, you know, that's the legend of Dave, because Dave obviously became so big and powerful at the end with the entire run. And that's what I think a lot of people focus on. But the lore has always been that he came in and made fun of Hollywood. You actually experienced while it was happening. We're like, yeah, these people are just regular people. We can poke fun at anybody we want. And by the way, were you dating her when you got the internship? Was that like, holy cow, look what Dave's yeah. going to do? Like, that must have, yeah. people must have freaked out when you were accepted into that program.
It was that there was a very nice going away party for me. and I remember driving home. I had to go to Philly first to drop my car off, very hungover on the 95. Just, oh, stay awake. Must get to New York. But good. Yeah, that was, they were very excited for me. The at the time, I had a scholarship. And to keep the scholarship, I had to take 16 credits every quarter. And the internship was only worth 12 credits. So I told my counselor, I'll do an independent study for 4 credits. And he was like, great. And then when I got back to school, I hadn't completed the independent study. And he was kind of mad at me. And he's like, why didn't you call me? I was like, I didn't have a phone.
Yeah.
You know, the idea was I would shoot some sort of documentary in New York. And I'm like, I didn't have money. How was I going to rent a camera crew and shoot anything?
Yeah.
So I managed to do something to get the 4 credits. And it was like literally the scholarship was $500 a year. So for that quarter, it was like $160 that I was fighting over for the scholarship. And the guy's still there, David Mould at Ohio University.
Really? Well, I mean, I'm curious about that because, okay, so you finish the internship, you go back to school, and then you go back to the production at the end of the year. Did you quit school so you could go into it and get the job? Or
the they wanted me to stay. They even got me a job offer at Lindy's restaurant, which was on the ground floor. And I couldn't afford it. Yeah. Even if, you know, working as a waiter at Lindy's, it was still, my intent was to go back for one more quarter to get my degree,
yep.
which was ridiculous. It was a video production degree, and every 12-year-old kid now can do more on his computer with movie making than my video production degree got me.
Yeah. Yep.
But I felt I had to do it. So I went down and worked 2 jobs down Wildwood, New Jersey as a lifeguard and a bouncer, and went back to the falls quarter. There were quarters at OU, and then went back to Philly, worked at Lee's Hoagie House, trying to get PA jobs. And one night at Lee's Hoagie House, the manager yelled at me because I put the meat on the hoagie first instead of the cheese, and which Cardinal is sin. Correct way. It is the correct way. But I was just like, you're telling me how to make a sandwich. I'm done. I'm going to California. So 2 days later, I was driving across country to move into a studio apartment with 3 other guys that I went to college with to just get TV jobs. And that didn't that didn't work out. And I just like, my head was, you know, I my only thing I want to do is work and write for Letterman. I got to go back there.
Yeah.
So I went back to New York, was working at Tower Records and let them know where I was. Got the phone call that the receptionist job opened. And I was like, yeah, boom, I'll take that. And then it was like, it was paid $300 a week. And I was stunned. It's like, that's a lot of money. Oh my God. I had to work two jobs to make $300 a week.
So you could sustain yourself on the reception job working at Letterman in New York back in the day.
For $300 a week. Yeah.
What part of town did you live in?
I bounced around a lot that first year. I was in Queens, Astoria, Queens for a couple months. Then I moved into Inwood at like 205th Street with a roommate. That apartment kept getting broken into, so we decided it wasn't the right spot for us. And I moved into the George Washington Hotel on 23rd in Lexington.
Yeah.
Literally, the room was 8 foot by 10 foot. My bed squeezed with a typewriter table fit and with my VCR and TV at the end at the foot of the bed.
Yep.
And then I got the writer's assistant gig and got a little pay bump. So moved up a bit. Mostly I stayed on the Upper East Side in New York. I didn't go to the West Side.
Yeah. So 84, you're working for Letterman. You're the receptionist.
86 was the receptionist.
Oh, so 86. So between, okay, so that's good context. So between when you got the internship, figured all your stuff out, California, no, I really want to be working for Letterman and Company. By 86, you're there permanently and full time.
Yes.
Okay. So by this point, and you're the reception. I don't know. Like, I know at the end, like, I mean, there's multiple receptions for multiple departments and things like that. I would imagine at that point there, you were the hub. There was one reception for the entire production at that point, right?
Yes. And then I believe they split it over to the talent department. So there may have been a talent department receptionist, but everybody's line was on the main hub sitting there. And it was a busy job. The phones were ringing, that's for sure.
I can imagine. And 86, like, I mean, by this point here, the show is the momentum of the show is incredible. It's one of the hippest shows on TV. This is the part where they're saying it's reinventing TV, all of that stuff. And you're right in the kind of the epicenter of it. What were the kinds of calls you would get? Like, I mean, is it literally everything across every department? Would you get, Shecky told me he thinks he remembers a story of certain comedians trying to call in to get on the show, that kind of stuff. Like you must have had a bunch of regular business type stuff and then a whole bunch of red herrings that would just show up as well. Crazy fans, all that kind of stuff. You must have just had everything.
Yeah. You know, most of it was business, like passing calls on to Sondra Furton. A lot of people wanting to get on the writing staff, want to get booked on the show. And then there was just the cranks that it was. I remember one call specifically, and Mary Connolly brings this up every time I see her, where I kept the guy on the line asking him, why would you do this? Why are you calling me? I have other people I need to talk to. Why? What is your point? Why? And once they got the number, they could keep calling.
Right.
And so it was pre-cranked Yankers, but it was the when I moved on to writer's assistant was when I kept a file of the scary people that wrote in. And because Dave had that stalker for a while.
Did she ever write in? Did any of her notes ever pass your hands?
Yes.
Whoa.
And there were others that weren't as intent or intense.
Yep.
But that's the call stuff. The thing that I just remember. The telephone had five rows of phone numbers, probably five or six deep. And I remember putting a bingo across the top. And I said, if I ever get a coverall, I'm out of here. So if all the lights were blinking on hold, that was my time to go. That was enough.
Whoa. That's bonkers. That's bonkers that, yeah, I mean, again, this is history of the show. That stalker was such a, you know, and Dave eventually started talking about it on the air and all that kind of stuff. But that's one of those things where, yeah, the job is, you know, dealing with some crazy fans and stuff, but sometimes the job is really intense and you've got some really crazy fans to deal with here. That's very interesting. And you kept a file of that when you went over to the writer's assistant.
I'm separating the two jobs. The phone call stuff, yeah. I didn't get on file, but the viewer mail stuff, you know, all the mail went to the writer's assistant.
Right.
Whatever
okay.
It was.
Yeah.
Everything from invoices to fan letters and gifts for Dave and stuff like that. And the odd weird person who was more the stalker type. But I don't think there was a private detective involved. I remember I kept a file and I was asked to. I believe Lori Diamond was instructed me to do that at the time. So
viewer mail, anything that went on the viewer mail segment, and I mean, there's so many. I mean, you talk about the gold that was the viewer mail segment, how much comedy could be taken out of that, whether it was you know, a question that led to a remote or a produced piece or an audience piece or whatever, the versatility of what came in the viewer mail. A lot of that for a certain amount of time passed your hands first. You were the first kind of guy that would be the what made for you know, obviously you get the hang of that, you know, and you're going to hand something over to Merrill or to O'Donnell, whoever you would have handed that to. I'm curious who would you handed it to, and what was it that would light up the light bulb above your head to go, okay, this is one that I think I'm going to move over to those guys to see if there's something here.
The daily routine was to get through as much that came in. There was like five boxes of mail waiting to get read. And at the end of the day, well, it would accumulate and then you can only get through so much and so grow. There were people in a way, it's sort of the precursor to like Twitter, because there are people who really got it and could write really funny letters that they knew how to make them open-ended for a reply.
Yep.
And so they were snarky. But sometimes the ones that were serious were even better.
Yep.
The complaints and stuff. But so there was a gamut to it. So every day I put a packet together, Xeroxed them for all the writers, but 12 or 14 writers, I think at the time, and just put it on their desk and they get a fresh packet every day to find the letter that struck a note with them to come up with a reply.
And would you do that? Would you give it to certain writers or was it?
No, they all got the same packet.
They all got the same packet. I see what you're saying. Okay.
It was kind of competitive because they only did five letters a week and there's 12 writers and you want to get stuff on the air. And that was one of the more open-ended ways to get material on, and you know, other than the top 10, that was another avenue. But that was fun.
O'Donnell talked a little bit about the process of the top 10, and a few other folks did as well, as they've been on the show. And so when you were apparently, and I'm not sure if it evolved into the place where everybody could just write top 10 submissions and things like that, or if it was like that back then, but were you throwing in submissions for the top 10 when you were the writer's assistant, when you were at reception? Were you doing that right from the start, saying, hey, I want to be writing for this show, and here's an avenue to show that I want to be writing for the show, and if I have talent for it, and to learn all that? Were you submitting right away?
Not right away. I felt my oats a little bit to make sure it was cool.
Yeah.
Adam Resnick preceded me as the writer's assistant.
Yeah.
And he was writing monologue jokes, opening remarks for Dave as the writer's assistant and other stuff. And I didn't want to be presumptuous that it would be cool if I did it too. So I took my time. As the receptionist, Barbara Gaines actually suggested that I write and submit Man Who's and From New York's. So that was my first little writing contribution. And there was, it was such a endorphin rush when I would get a page back with checks that Dave liked this one and this one. I'm like, oh yeah. My God, this is great.
Yeah.
They like me. Maybe this will happen.
So those check marks, so many folks have talked about those check marks and how talk about gold stars in school. I mean, yeah. that's just, there's no bigger endorsement than one little check mark beside something that you wrote. Do you remember any of the ones that got on the air? Do you remember the first one that got on the air? Man From or the New York?
The one I remember is a little wordy.
Yeah.
It was From New York, the city we liked when we saw the blueprints, but upon completion, we were like, meh. that's not the exact phrasing, because meh is
more that recent, is wordy. That is really wordy for one of those. And that's on the air. Story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. And there you go, Bill.
Yeah.
Bill earned his paycheck that night.
That's a lot to spit out.
That's a good one. And you were a writer's assistant when that happened.
That I might have been reception then, because that's when I started writing the those Man Who's. That's when Barbara Babbs suggested.
I love that, and I don't know if it came from Barbara or if it just came from Dave's sensibility or where it came from. But the idea that all of you. And it was a revolving door of people coming and going, but you all were a family and it was like, everybody can contribute. And that seems to be the show's moniker, you know, and that's off screen and on screen, certainly. And we'll talk about that with you in a minute here, because you got lots of on screen stuff as well. But it seems like they, and I don't know if it was Barbara who cultivated that culture or where that came from, but a team atmosphere right from the beginning, it sounds like.
Yeah, you know, there was lines you didn't want to cross, but if you had an idea, they were open to hearing it.
Yeah.
I just went dead. I'll think of it.
Okay.
You had triggered something with
the idea of there being a team contributing, family.
The show, it was its own farm system in a way.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the Joe Fury followed my footsteps of being the intern for Ed Hall, receptionist, and then writer's assistant, then writer. And it was sort of a way, you know, of going to Dave's school, as Boyd Hale once called it,
mm-hmm.
where you learned the things like, Dave won't wear a hat, you know, as silly and minor as that sounds.
Yeah.
And you just, it was definitely a process of learning his sensibility and word choice. And so being around it made it happen.
Well, I don't know if Steve Weiner was still there. I think you guys may have just passed each other as a writer, but I think Steve Weiner talked about that, because he went after Letterman. He went and worked for Robert Klein, and talking as a writer, writing for somebody in particular, not just a show, but for somebody. And I think it's a little bit different than a sitcom and things like that, because it's not situational. You're literally funneling it through this person's voice and personality and all of that. Learning his voice, you know, and not crossing lines like you're talking about, you know, like you almost want to imitate him to see if he says the words, you know what I'm saying? Like,
and it definitely, his attitude and sensibility definitely influences everybody that was there. I mean, not just, you know, you almost have to stop yourself from saying catchphrases, because you everyone's going, well, you took that from Letterman.
Right. So, right. I mean, I don't know how much of my vocabulary to this day has Lettermanisms inserted in it. And I mean, those Lettermanisms, yeah, maybe they were spoken through his mouth, but they're also written by, you know, hundreds of people over the years that, you know, it's such an interesting conglomeration, how these things are all mixed together. And then how a guy from Western Canada, you know, who never had any physical contact with these people, is saying these words, and it all started from maybe a reception desk or you know, an office somewhere in New York. It's so fascinating. And that's the idea that Dave is a broadcaster rather than a comedian or an entertainer, you know, put through that lens. That's what you guys did. And to this day, there are echoes of that, including, you know, many of the phrases. I think good Lord is something I say all the time because of Dave, like just little things like that. Did that affect your writing after you left Letterman? I can't imagine. I mean, your formative years were there, and we'll get back to how it evolved after the writing assistant in a second. But that certainly must have influenced any project that you have been a part of since then, because it's your formative years in the business.
Absolutely. It created my sensibility, and every other show that I worked on after that, they knew what I was going to produce.
Right.
You know, when you hired me, you knew my style, I guess. Whether it was darker or edgier or more offbeat, that was sort of my, you know, if maybe everybody says that about themselves, but that's sort of my take on me as a writer.
Yeah. And you knew you wanted to be a writer. That was it, right? Was performing ever something that you wanted to do?
No, and that's every bit I was in, I was biting my inside of my cheeks to not break out into laughter.
Really?
I was so afraid I'd blow it. One time it was a Who Asked For It.
Yep.
And you know, we went up and you'd say somebody else's name, a friend's name.
Yep.
And I went up, it was my turn, and I went up and I said, I'm Dave, Billy Patton. Cause I was just so nervous. I was going to say my own name. I want to be Billy Patton. And Dave sort of mocked me a little bit for it. Like, oh, okay, Billy.
Yeah, well, that was the gold stuff. Whenever that would happen, Steve Young had a moment like that too. And I forget, but there was three people with the same name, and he messed up the first name of the three. And Letterman just took off with that and ran. And that became the nexus of the bit. Like that became, that was it. Are you talking about the one where you... who asked for it, where you hammered your arm to the seat?
No, that was I didn't speak on those ones. I was just an annoying audience member. That was Adam Resnick's bit where they hammered my arm once. Did they cut it off? I think there was more than one. That was Adam's.
It's There's a compilation of those that. On Giller's channel. It's been a while since I've watched all of them, but there is a for the Who Asked For It. It's definitely worth watching, and we'll link to it after on the YouTubes anyway, on the Spotify's and the Apples. Sure. We'll just tell you, go to Don Giller's channel, Who Asked For It. There's the compilation there. So Adam writes this thing, and it's like, okay, we're gonna need four people who are annoying audience members or whatever it is. We're gonna need three or four people for this. How does it get divvied up as to who performs in it? Like, or Father Biff, for example. Father Biff, by the way, I mean, holy smokes, you want to talk after school specials? They got nothing on Father Biff. Thank you very much. Did you get to keep that leather jacket, by the way?
No, no. There was, I didn't realize there were so many of them. I think there was 15 or 16. And those were great. I like me and Ed Hall as the punks. Always. We there weren't two cleaner cut looking guys around the office, and all right, throw a leather coat on them and put a cigarette in their mouth.
Yeah. So how do you get chosen? Why is that you that's doing that?
Steve did most of the casting, and so it was on him.
Steve O'Donnell did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And he spread the wealth. I think it was a kind of him.
Yeah.
You know, $175 after checks certainly helped the living in Manhattan.
Yeah.
I had appeared so much. Actually, I just got an AFTRA residual check, which I haven't gotten in 20 years, for like $190. And like, it doesn't say what it's for, but I'm assuming it's YouTube money or something, or some kind of clip fee. They didn't, usually they list the shows that, are involved. But I'm retired from AFTRA, and when I'm 65, I will get $165 a month pension.
Because of all the appearances on Letterman.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. That is, this is the one thing too, that I do want this show to be able to differentiate, because a lot of folks outside of show business don't understand the union aspect of it, and not just the union, but the multiple unions who are involved here. And you know, we're gonna have Pat Farmer on in a couple of weeks. That's gonna be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And Glenn Borders and stuff, who is one of the construction guys as well. We're gonna have them on here and talk a little bit about that, because you know, it's in some ways union versus union, and what certain employees can do and what certain ones can't do. And when Dave would, you know, he would literally pick anybody. It might be someone from reception. You know, you mentioned the bookmobile, Kathleen Anchors, who might be on the show. You know, shout out to Kathleen Anchors, by the way.
Oh, yeah. She was delightful. She was so amazing.
Yeah. Do you have any Kathleen Anchors stories?
She invited me to a dinner once at her apartment, and she made the most incredible Vietnamese food. And I don't know why I was invited. I think I was too dumb to realize. I think she was trying to introduce me to a young woman there. And I was just, I was so clueless that I was just like, this is great food.
Well, she appears cultured. She appears like she.
Oh my God. Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh. Oh, that's beautiful. Oh, that's so awesome. And that's, yeah. So anyway, we want to talk about, you know, the idea of the different unions and how many people, when they made on-screen appearances, what it turned into for them. That is so funny. I mean, I'm not sure how many times you appeared on the show over the years. When that happened, did it disrupt your work day? Like, were you one of the guys when you became a writer, were you one of the guys in the room waiting in case you had to do a new top 10 or whatever, but, oh no, I got to be part of the show today?
I probably appeared less when I was a writer than, because I did have to churn out the material.
Yeah.
But yeah, my heyday was in appearances was receptionist and writer's assistant and intern. I was in a bunch of bits as an intern. I think I was a Blue Angel, if you remember that thing where there were five Blue Angels in flight suits,
like the jet planes. Blue Angels. Yeah. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And the gag was that the Blue Angels are here and they're going to show us one of their aerial stunts, and we basically did a formation on our feet and put our arms out and just flew around in formation in the studio. And I had a mustache then, so I got cast because I looked like I was in the military.
Because the pilot or the mustache. Yeah. Okay. There you go. There you go. Before we move on to the writer part, and I want to find out about the transition from writer assistant to writer. Any other stories from when you were a writer assistant that want to pop out right now that just come to mind that you want to throw out there?
The one story I was as writer's assistant with Opening Viewer Mail, the one story I wanted to tell you is one of the grossest things I ever got was a guy sent a Polaroid in of his naked self.
Oh boy.
And he wrote on it, "I'm angry for you, Dave." And so I had mentioned this and somebody said, "Oh my God, that's the first dick pic."
Right?
I had to think about that. So, yeah.
Selfies weren't a thing back then, folks.
No, no. And
they certainly weren't.
That seared into my memory.
I can imagine it is.
Into viewer mail.
I'm angry for you, Dave.
Yeah.
Which is, okay, the syntax of that sentence is actually kind of funny. Like, it's almost like, you know, the broken English part of it. But yeah, that's yeah.
It never made it to Mr. Letterman's desk.
No, that's really. I can't imagine how that one wouldn't have been filtered through. That's why you got to keep the job. Yeah. You knew how to filter that stuff. Now, you're doing the writer assistant job. How long did you do that job for?
It's about 2 years.
Okay, so you were You know, you learned a lot, I imagine, in those 2 years. And the entire time, still ambitious to move up, and they knew it?
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Was biding my time. A couple openings happened, and I got passed over.
Yeah.
Happens. So at one point, I had actually applied for David Brenner's show.
Yeah.
And but that might have been when I was receptionist. I think that show was on when I was still receptionist.
Okay.
But I didn't get hired, obviously.
Thankfully.
Yeah. The I was getting stuff on the show pretty regularly. I was I knew I had the ability. It just was the patience for the right spot. And I got hired. We were in Chicago for the first week of Chicago shows that they did.
Yeah.
And on the last day, after the taping, I think we took a picture, staff picture on the stage, and everyone dispersed. And I was sitting there with Steve O'Donnell on the set. And he just says, well, I guess this is as good a time as any to tell you, we're going to bring you on the writing staff. So that's like the best memory of Kevin Curran was the writer that left to go to Married with Children, I believe.
Yeah.
And that was the staff opening that I filled. So pretty big shoes to fill.
Well, yeah, no kidding. Casey St. Ong was on here. She was Dave's assistant. Okay. So, you know, Casey, she was his assistant Okay. And she talked about how, folks in the show were big on gestures from Dave all the way down. You know, like she talked about when she was told, you know, they were skating. I think it was around Rockefeller Center. They were skating through an ice rink or whatever. And Dave stopped her and said, hey, we want to bring you on. And it was almost like this gesture. And you're talking about the way O'Donnell said that to you as well. In Chicago, you know, you're at the height, this adrenaline is coming. Cause I mean, those are special shows. I mean, when you guys were take the show on the road, those are special shows. And all these years later, I mean, we're 30 something years later and you're talking about that being a shining memory. That is such a beautiful sentiment. Now, that being said, that beautiful sentiment then leading to you being part of one of the, I mean, I'll throw this out there, one of the most talented for sure, maybe competitive writing staffs in the history of TV, a cutting edge. I mean, were you self-aware at that point of, holy shit, this is probably one of the most exclusive writing rooms ever?
I was and now so I'm in self-aware there. That I had to go to a dermatologist to get UV treatment because my body broke out in hives.
Wow. Okay. You were aware.
Cause I was like, okay, now it's on. I gotta, now it's a job. Oh
yeah.
Crap. I gotta keep up. So, yeah. And it was a competitive, like I said, the slots to get material on.
Yep.
Were limited. And, so you had to keep your nose down to the grindstone and pound out the material and accept the rejection rate and just keep pitching.
So, how many of you were there at that point?
I think it was around 12.
Okay. It's around 12 of you. Okay. Certain amount of slots per night. Yeah. It's crazy. It's breakneck. Most of what you submit is not going to be even looked at twice. Many questions come from this. When Steve Young talked about when O'Donnell, like there, Steve O'Donnell's name has come up. He's been on two episodes already and he's come up so often because so many people have such reverence for him. And there's a reputation that has really developed through whether it's Kellison or Young or some of these other people that have been on the show, Tommy Ruprecht. I don't know if Tommy talked about O'Donnell, but anyway, a bunch of people have talked about O'Donnell and how he just had the reputation of pulling people up and inspiring people and giving people chances, that sort of a thing. When you got the job for the first time, did he hand you anything and say, okay, start working on, was it, you know, bookmobile or start working on certain things? Or was it just, you have been a writer's assistant long enough, wide open pasture?
Yeah, it was more that I knew the drill.
Yeah.
And we had, you know, there would be the board, the schedule, would, you know, they'd have guests and the comedy pieces and viewer mail was always up there.
Yeah.
And there was two acts of comedy, act one and act five. And it was daunting to look at the board and not see a card with a comedy bit on it. Like, you know, it's
so that's even less Dave, now.
Yeah, a Dave remote, bookmobile, who asked for it? And you're like, all right, we did who asked for it too much. We got to come up with something else.
Yeah.
And the show, one of the directives from Dave to the writers was to open up, because we were very self-referential and, you know, exposing the inner workings of a late night talk show. And sure. He felt like at some point we were navel gazing and maybe we needed to expand what the bits were.
Yeah.
He put out, you knew what to write because it was on the board. So, all right, we need jokes for the remote. We need jokes. We need bookmobile jokes. We need wacky props, etiquette pieces, which is another prop piece. But in between filling the jokes in those bits was the hardest part, coming up with fresh new refillables.
Yeah.
And even fresh new one-offs. The easy pieces to do were, we called them extras, desk extras, I believe they were called. And they were just one-off jokes that, you know, it could have been something as simple as a joke off of a TV guide cover or something like that. I don't have a specific.
Sure.
It wasn't 10. If you could come up with an idea that you could cram 10 different jokes in, like the top 10, I had this theory that the top 10 made the show harder because it was one setup and 10 jokes, just verbal jokes.
Yeah.
Whereas some of the top 10 lists could have been props, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And, but they got so chiseled down to a verbal joke and it only took up a minute and a half of the show. It's like, can we go back to doing these as bits? I know it's, you know, it's funnier and paced better, but it's interesting to watch the old shows actually, just for the pacing, to me, and not just the comedy, the whole format of the show to watch. And then you see Jimmy Fallon's Tonight Show. It's like, wow, that's changed. It's everything is a circus and loud and keep things moving. You don't want people to turn that dial.
Yeah, that's for sure. And I love the pacing of late night. Like, yeah, because late show is probably the bridge in between those two eras that you just talked about. You know, you guys went from I don't want to call it relaxed because it certainly wasn't relaxed, but it definitely had the feel of a looseness to it. It went away. The moment they got the 11:30 show, it was like, okay, well, no, now we got to complete with the Tonight Show and we're having to change our sensibilities. And then, you know, by the time Dave finished off his late show run in 15, you know, late night TV had already, you know, Corden was already on the air and Fallon was already doing his things with his games and all these different things. And that is but you don't get to what Fallon is doing on the Tonight Show without what you guys did on late night. That's the thing. Like that's that the inventiveness and the wacky things that you guys did. You know, there's a clear line of evolution there. And you were a part of that. I want to know, were there any bits of material that you wrote or that you were a part of that started as one thing and then turned into something else completely and was aired?
I don't have a recollection of that.
Okay.
The one character that I created that didn't have a long shelf life was Tick Boy. I think Tick Boy only made two appearances. and Tick Boy's didn't speak, and it was a full, I was Tick Boy. It was a full costume. And in the there was a little scripted bit where my answer was supposed to be no, and I could just turn my body as a no. And the way Dave phrased the question was different, and it would have required a yes answer. And I just froze, like, I don't know how to say yes in Tick Boy. So I'm not sure if that was why Tick Boy was eradicated, but It was funny because we played softball after that, and Dave yep. actually said, "Hey, sorry about that. I messed you up on Tick Boy." And I was like, "I couldn't shake yes. I guess I could have gone like this, but I don't know what that would have looked like."
Did Sue make that costume for you?
I believe she did. Who was the other costume? Eric Anthony didn't build the stuff. I guess it had to be. Yeah.
Yeah, it would have been Sue. We're trying to get her. I've got a connection with her, but we haven't had her on the show yet. I'm very excited about that. Lots of meat on that bone when it comes to Sue Hum and the different jobs that she's had over the years, the different tasks that she's been given. Well, and again, another person on the staff that was incredibly funny and had the sensibility that you all just seem to have. Let's talk a little bit about, we're gonna get back to some writing in a second here. I'll throw out the idea of things that you got on the show that you were proud of, or things that maybe you always wanted a second crack at. We'll kind of let your subconscious think about that a little bit, because I want to talk about Calvert a little bit. I mean, Steve Weiner, again, writer, he's the guy, he and Carl discovered Calvert, and that, so we've talked, we're going to do a Calvert tribute episode at some point. It was the Pan American Journey.
The Calvert DeFarge Pan American Goodwill Tour.
Goodwill Tour, yes. So, and you're actually on tour with Calvert.
The backstory was that I was a writer's assistant then. Steve came in to tell the writers, Dave loves this idea. Who wants to go? And all the writers were like, I'm married. I have kids. I have a family. This is a indeterminate trip. So no one volunteered. And after the meeting closed up, and I went to my office and went, wait a second, I'm not married.
Yeah,
I can go. I can do this. So I volunteered, and Steve was like, oh yeah, that'd be great. So the problem with it was that no camera crew could go, because that would be too expensive, because it would have to be a NABIT camera crew.
Okay.
And that would have been hugely expensive to pay their room rate and all that every night, and as much as their day rate and all that. So all we had was that Panasonic video phone that's interlaced, scanned a black and white picture, very grainy.
Yeah.
And Dave even said on the show one time, you could just be backstage. We were on the road for 6 weeks.
On the road for six full weeks for that.
Yeah. One of the weeks was a dark week too. So they called it off when we got to Guatemala City. Calvert would fluctuate between being miserable and being happy. And by that time, I think we were calling it off. We had run out of vehicles. The RV we left in, we had to leave at Laredo, Texas, at the border, because we weren't insured to take it into Mexico. So we rented a 16 passenger van in Laredo, and whoever that was we rented it from wouldn't let us take it further than Monterey, which was about 60 miles south of the border. And then we rented a Ford Taurus, and we could only take that to the Guatemala border, because we weren't insured to take it into Guatemala. And then we took a, it's called a chicken bus. They're basically school buses.
Okay, so it's a converted school bus. It's like you see in the movies.
Yeah, exactly. And there were chickens in cages on the bus, just being transported. And it was a 5-hour bus ride, because they stopped in every small town from the border to Guatemala City. And at that point, what am I going to rent in Guatemala City to keep going down to Tierra del Fuego? So they called it off, and they flew Calvert home, and me and the driver, who was a friend of mine, who was a mechanic that they brought on just in case there was car trouble.
Sure.
We collected all the vehicles and made it. We made it. It took us 6 weeks to get to Guatemala City, and we made it back in 18 hours because we dropped the rental car off at an airport in South Mexico. We flew to Monterey to pick up the van, drove the van, got the RV, and just we alternated every 2 hours, sleeping and driving to get back. It was that was an adventure, just getting everything collected and returned. And
I'm blown away by this. So that entire trip, that entire bit that went on and on and on, and always had little remotes and updates and all that. Three of you total, and it was over 6 weeks.
It was four of us. Calvert had a friend, Frank.
Okay.
Traveling with him, and but Frank left. I think when we got to New Orleans, he had a family thing he had to deal with. So then it was just the three of us into the last couple of weeks.
Okay. So a lot of downtime. I mean, you got times where, okay, yeah, you're recording, you're doing these things. The downtime must have been, was it boring? Did you guys get to know each other completely? You knew each other's secrets by the end of this? Did you hate each other by the end of it? What a crazy thing.
There was some tension between Calvert and I that started on the first trip. We were the first call in, we were in Lexington, and we butted heads a little bit because it was a college campus.
Yeah.
Everybody recognized him, and he was giving away all the t-shirts, and we only had a limited supply of late night t-shirts.
Right.
And I said, no more. And he got mad at me, and he called his agent, and his agent called Morty, and Morty called me, and he said, you got to treat Calvert like a star. And it's but I need the t-shirts. I don't know how long I'm going to be on the road.
Yeah.
So, and it was something silly like that, but I accommodated him. I tried to, I don't think I was ever mean. I think we were both a little frustrated because the traveling wasn't hard, but it was mapping everything out. Where do we get to next?
No GPS back then.
No, we had all the maps. we did have one of the original mobile phones in a attaché case that was
like a bag big phone. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a big brick. it was quiet, and Calvert, kept to himself. He enjoyed the scenery while we were driving.
Yeah.
And we did, the week that they were down, we were in Huatulco, which is on the, I guess that's the Pacific Ocean. It's a beach community. And we stayed at a hotel. It was a Sheraton that hadn't really opened yet. So the accommodations weren't spectacular. And we were at the beach, and we looked across the cove, and it was like, what's that place over there? And it was a Club Med. So we drove over to Club Med, and I had the Amex card from the show, and I said, can we stay here for 3 days? And so we had fun at Club Med for 3 days. Calvert enjoyed that. Yeah, he had a fun there. But he took a spill and broke his glasses. I was like, at that point, I sort of was like, I'm responsible for this human being. I gotta probably be taking better care of him. But I kept him alive for 6 weeks. When we got back, they cast me in a bit, and I can't remember what it was, but it was with Calvert. And the punchline of the joke was I had to hit Calvert over the head with a board, and the board was supposed to break, and it was balsa wood. And when I hit him, it didn't break, even though it was scored, and it didn't break. And I don't think it hurt, but he just said on camera, son of a bitch. And so we did another take, and it broke. And that's the clip that went in the show, in the bit. But then in the commercial, they rolled in the son of a bitch line.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So, I was going to ask. So you get back, things get back to normal or pseudo normal or whatever. you and Calvert, when you see each other on set, different dynamic at that point, I imagine.
It was all fine. I mean, that was the first thing. That was sort of like breaking any ice that there might have been between us.
Oh, that's what I'm saying. Like just you have this history now that just did not exist beforehand, and it's a unique type of experience together. Whenever you travel somewhere with somebody afterwards, you always have that little bond. And
I'm actually working on, I had an idea for a mockumentary where I show the real clips of Calvert and Dave appearances. Like I said, there is 8 of them, just edit it down and then show these exaggerated clips of what went on between city stops. So, and it gets pretty nuts. I mentioned the idea to Donna Carey, and he asked if I had read Norm MacDonald's bio. So I read it, and it's like, I don't know if you've read it.
His
memoir.
Yeah. And it reads like a bio, but it's all made up.
Yeah, it's nuts. And
yeah, it's bonkers.
So I said, I went that direction with the Calvert thing to the point where a rival TV show is sending another celebrity down to Tierra del Fuego, and it becomes a race to get there.
So, awesome. Yeah. Take my money. I'm in.
Let's see if I can get that out.
Oh, that's cool. Okay, so that was when you were a writer's assistant, so you weren't even a writer at that point when that happened. So, you paid some dues, and you got some chops over those couple of years, that's for sure. Okay, so you become a writer. How long are you a writer for Late Night with David Letterman?
I was there about almost 2 years. When I left, was when Leno got the Tonight Show.
Okay.
And
all right, what a way to end right there. He left just as the late night wars, the late shift was happening. And then, you know what? You're going to have to come back for part two for the rest. And it is a fascinating tale. There's lots more Letterman stuff in part two, but it takes a bit of a shift. Part two is going to be very, very interesting. Turn of events for those of you who don't know Dave or Riggs, Dave Rygalski's, where his career went. I'll give you a couple hints. Chevy Chase Show, yup. The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, yup, along with Ed Hall. And then some stuff in between, but then another stint on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, and then also The Jay Leno Show. And back to the Tonight Show, and interesting, really interesting talking with Dave in part two. You're going to really enjoy part two because he has a different perspective than some of the other guests that we've had on the show. And I just really enjoyed this conversation. It was such a good conversation that it just went and went and went and went. The next episode is almost as long as as part one here. I'm very grateful that Dave opened up as much as he did about things. We talk about his reaction to the Super Bowl ad that had Oprah Winfrey and Jay Leno, of course, with Dave. And it's a fascinating perspective that Dave has. It really is. And I'm so grateful that he was an open book, and I can't wait to have him on again and talk about some of these things. I mean, that the road trip with Calvert, are you kidding me? You know, I would just recommend that everybody, I believe all of these clips, I don't think any of the stuff we talked about is on the Letterman YouTube channel yet, but much of it is certainly on Don's channel. The Father Biff's thing, and I think that's a 13-minute compilation. It's not, you know, I know some of these ones here have multiple parts at an hour and a half each. This one here, there's a lot of ones that are easier to ingest. And I think that, Who Asked For It? I think that's a compilation on Giller's channel. And I'm almost positive the Pan American Journey, Calvert's Pan American Journey, is on that one as well. So highly recommend taking a look at some of Dave's work, some of the things that he's done in there, and then come on in fresh. We're going to try and post some of these things in the Facebook group or on the Facebook page as well. We're going to post some of these links to direct people there, but I highly recommend you watch them. This is the classic stuff. I love when we have late night people on. And I mean, don't get me wrong, I love late show, but having the late night folks on talking about the history of these amazing iconic moments has been so good. We appreciate every single one of you. As always, please like, please share, please subscribe. We hope you're enjoying what we're doing here at the Letterman Podcast. That's part one of Dave Rygalski Riggs, episode 30, whatever it is. I think this is episode 31. Part two is coming next week. We appreciate every single one of you. We're having a lot of fun doing this. And thank you for indulging me in the red room tonight. Look at this. We got the mood lighting going on in the studio and all sorts of great things to come. More to come, as they say. So this has been yet another episode of the Letterman Podcast with Mike Chisholm. Coincidentally, I am Mike Chisholm. Thank you and good night.
Overcoat and underpants.